Hello, everybody. This is Manny Gomez with LRMonline.com, also with The Comic Source. This is part of Jace's, well, I'm actually being nice to him, and if he edits this out, fine, but he decided to go on this crazy journey of putting all kinds of content within the 12 days of Christmas every day, increasing his episodes by one. And so he started with one, and he's going to 12, and I can tell you right now, does not sleep much. So I am here with a good friend of mine, Chris Northrup, who I've known for a while now, thanks to...
Yeah, it's been a while.
Yeah. When was Eclipse dropped? What year was that?
Yeah, I've been around longer than that, but that's the first time you showed up. Yes. It was cool.
Yeah, I actually do remember when we met. We met at a small convention in Stockton. Of all places.
Is that the first one? I thought it was LA.
No, it was Stockton. For whatever reason, Top Cow had a corner booth in the back. Usually you guys are in the front. And Dylan, being the salesman that he is, and great guy, he was like, hey, got this new book coming out, Clips. And then that's when he introduced me to you. And I guess the rest is history.
Dylan Gray, the legendary marketing director at Top Cow.
That's right.
The man's a legend.
Yeah, I mean, I have a lot to be thankful for with Top Cow, because Jason and I started a podcast with the Top Cow universe, which led to better things, and now here I am. Mm. So, you know.
We love you.
Yeah. Thank you. But we're not talking about Top Cow today, although we hold them dear to our hearts. We're talking about a Dark Horse project that you had... I think a lot of people would say the privilege of working on, just because of how insanely big it's gotten.
I could tell you the wacky series of events that led to me being involved in advising on that project.
Well, I would love that. So let's get into it. Oh, we're talking about Critical Role, Vox Machina Origins, which obviously is, if you're into RPGs, if you're into Dungeons & Dragons, you know who this group of people are. And so Dark Horse was able to take that first season that they did and turn it into comic book form. Chris is the colorist on it, and it's also part of this lovely hardcover.
There it is.
Yeah.
Which just came out.
It's beautiful. If you need a last-minute Christmas present, buy this, because your Dungeons & Dragons friend will appreciate it very much. So yeah, let's hear it. How did you become involved with this?
How did I become involved with Critical Role? Well, I was teaching, I think you know, I was teaching at Meltdown Comics in West Hollywood. And I had a lot of students, and I taught coloring, writing, creating, project management, which is something that I do too. And one of my design students ended up working at Legendary Pictures, who Critical Role used to be a part of before they kind of went off and became their own entity. But he wanted to convince them to do a comic. He was like, they're crazy not to do a comic of this, you know, or a graphic novel. And he was like, you know, I'll bring you in and you can like explain how to make, because they didn't know how to make any kind of, you know, book really. Like they did not know the different aspects of making it, the process, like who you should hire, like what's normal, like, you know, like there was like not a lot of knowledge of whoever makes their comic books at Legendary, because they do make comic books. They weren't involved with this project. This project was all on Legendary Pictures Digital and Critical Role. So, you know, we basically sat in the war room, which is what they call it there in Burbank. And, you know, it was like, hey, this guy knows how to make comics. Like, check out all these books that he worked on and did and project managed and stuff. Let's bring him in. You know, they asked a ton of questions. You know, I got along with everybody. I liked it a lot. It's the first time I ever made a comic book or graphic novel with like boardroom meetings. That's never how you make comics. Usually you make comics over email and it's very loose. And this was very a lot of the project was vetted by the cast members. They all had input. Matt Colville wrote the script. It was constant. He was a video game. He is a video game writer. A lot of his work. So for him to work on a comic was kind of like, you know, everyone had to kind of learn that was in the room. So it was good that I had taught making comic books and graphic novels and project management at Meltdown, you know, and I think that's why my student brought me in to do this. And, you know, they hired me. So, and it was almost 2 years of my life working on that, on Critical Role. So.
Wow.
And I knew nothing. I knew nothing about it. I didn't even know what it was. When I walked in, I knew nothing. And I don't play D&D and I don't do the RPG thing. The most RPG I've ever done is like Zelda, which is not an RPG. At least previously, it's not, you know, Breath of the Wild is, but I had never even done any kind of role playing or anything. So I had to learn, you know, like they had to learn about comics. Like I had to learn about the world of role playing, you know, like there were like jokes where like I just didn't get it because, you know, like, you know, you take it for granted when like someone says like, oh man, critical hit, like when something goes wrong or something goes right.
Mm-hmm.
I really didn't know what that meant, you know, like there were tons of stuff, things like that that kept coming up. So I had to bulk up my knowledge of that working on it. So very cool experience.
That was my next question, actually, is how much did you know about Critical Role and how, you know, are you into RPGs and things like that? Now, after that, did you at all try to play Dungeons and Dragons? Are you still not into it?
I did. I for research to work on the project, to communicate with the team, it's good for everyone on the team to know the work involved with the other people, even if you're not doing that job and you're just kind of giving feedback and, you know, building something together. So I was like, oh man, I have this huge deficit in like what, you know, role-playing Dungeons and Dragons is. So I just hung out at Meltdown with my girlfriend at the time and like sat in on some games. You know, everyone knew me there. Like I was very, you know, juiced in with the community, even though I wasn't part of it. They were always there, you know, they were always playing Dungeons and Dragons while I was teaching a class or doing the zine program they had there, or anything like that. That was always there, you know, and kidding around with them anyway. But now I know what their jokes mean. So like, it was like leveling up. There you go.
It's funny because was it 2 or 3 years ago, I was at a WonderCon and they had a Critical Role people on stage. Yeah. And I was there for the next panel. And I was like, who are these people? But I was barely getting into the RPG world. And I think it was like 3 weeks later that I, thanks to the group I was in, finally learned who they were. And I was like, oh, I was feet away from them. It was funny.
Yeah. And it, like, one of the things that I didn't know going in that was cool was that they're all voice actors.
Mm-hmm.
For animation and film and all and video games and all kinds of things. So I had heard, you know, their voices before, you know, in all kinds of games and animation and movies and stuff. So I did not know that walking in. I was like, oh, okay. That's why it's so well done, because they're just naturally trained to just improv in character, you know, all the time. So, and I met Mercer at Meltdown before I was on the project, like a couple of times too. I mean, I didn't know who he was or what. He was just a guy with like long brown hair, you know, just another D&D. I didn't know, you know, so.
Yeah, that's totally acceptable. I mean, this is great. I mean, I had no idea that you had, you know, such an active role in the beginning of this project. So how did the process go for picking a writer, an artist, and then probably mapping out some of those key points in the story?
So when I came in there, they already had Matt locked in to write it. Because he writes a lot of D&D stuff online and campaigns and stuff. And, you know, the two Matts, there's two, right? So just call them the two Matts, right? So, so Matthew Mercer was, definitely like involved and like overseeing it and stuff, but, Colville was writing scripts, you know, Because he's just done a lot of D&D stuff before in role playing in the video game world. So, they had just hired Olivia Sampson, let me get her thing over here. Okay, so Olivia, so I have the book too. My comp copy, which I love. So Olivia was hired, before I got there, but she was a fan. Like, she did fan illustration. She's part of, Critical Role has a huge fan art community.
Yes.
And it includes a lot of people who are really good who are unpublished. Like, it's a really good resource. So editors, go take a look, because there's a lot of people posting a lot of stuff. And, when they're drawing the Critical Role stuff, these fans are passionate. So those pieces are, really good examples of what they can do. We basically had a page or two pages from Olivia, and it was the discussions were, do we make these panels all widescreen like a movie? This is what I mean, it wasn't known how to do a lot of stuff, because she was coming in without having been published by a company like Dark Horse before, or something like that. So it was even the scripts, how much words is too much on a page? How many panels is too much? How does this affect the flow? And Olivia worked and kind of adapted some of the scripts to bump things and move things and get it, very streamlined to end an issue where it has to end. If you look at the chapters in the collection, a lot of them are 22 pages. Some of them are 26. And that's how the comics were published, because the whole thing was, this isn't getting published physically, mm-hmm. So, they're expecting 22 pages. If you give them more because you can't fit all of this in 22, go for it. They're not going to complain, and they're not going to change the price on Comixology or anything,
Right.
So there was a lot of freedom if it needed more or if it needed less. And that was something that we were constantly looking at in our meetings, and we did voice calls sometimes twice a week about it. It was a very team oriented production in every sense of the word, so
the idea was to release it digital only.
It was digital. It was digital only. Yeah, it's never been printed as single issues except once, the first issue of the first volume was printed for Emerald City Comic Con, and it was gone and I don't even have it, and I see it on eBay constantly because it's the one time they printed the first part of this series ever. I wish I had it because at the time when they did that, I didn't know if it was ever going to be collected. I thought it was just going to live forever digitally. And, I have all the master files for all this, and I lettered the book too. So I have the raw, I had the whole book, but I wanted that first one so bad because it was the first thing I ever worked on for Dark Horse that had the Dark Horse logo on it with my name on the cover. And I was that's really cool. I had never worked with or for Dark Horse before on a project in any capacity. It's always been Image, always in Top Cap. So for a career point of view, it was a real boon and a big leap to be involved in Critical Role and dealing with Dark Horse and stuff, and being published by them, because it's led to a lot, to be involved with a licensed property that large.
Yes.
I can ask for certain things now that you would never be able to ask for when you're on a project, because I have this huge tome in front of me, of work that, and I think for everyone that worked on it, it was really it's also very good because this thing is over 375 pages, and it's a licensed property that was carefully monitored, and it shows that you can go the distance and finish something. I'm super proud of it. I'm super proud of everyone who worked on it. So
Well, I'm gonna be real.
I don't think that was the question, but I'm very proud of.
No, that's fine.
My co-creators and artists and everything. Very proud of them.
I would be real. Looking through it, I do feel like it's a very still a cohesive story, but it does stick to those D&D, not rules, but kind of that the spirit of, you know, some things happen when some things happen or some things don't happen. And I really enjoyed that. Because
it does feel like dice are rolling sometimes, yes, on some scenes.
Yeah, and that's what makes it fun, because that's what in essence it is. So,
right.
So it's a great job. So your role as a colorist, how much was that all your input, or did they want a specific palette?
I mean, no, they didn't have a specific. I had done, first off, I have to do test pages every time I do a project, right? Whether I pitch my own original project or I come onto a project, and they have to decide if you know, you're a good fit. Doesn't mean you're not a good colorist if you don't get it. It doesn't mean you're not a good writer if you don't get it. It's about if your voice and your style fits the property or what you're trying to achieve. So I had gone through a more painted look initially, but the whole thing with it was coming out every single month. You know, pages were being handed in, 2 pages, 3 pages, 4 pages, 2 pages. You know, sometimes there would be a scene that's more complicated and that would get done first. And then it would be like, you know, pages 15 and 16. And we had only gone up to 10, and all of a sudden 15 and 16 show up. So I made the decision to do it more cel shaded looking, you know, with complementary colors, and just, you know, establish a style. Like, that's the way, because Olivia's artwork looks animated. So it doesn't pay to, that's the thing about coloring. Like, you don't want to drown out the, you know, the artist. Like, I think color is super, super important to comic books and film and any kind of visual medium. It's paramount. It's so important. You know, it's as important as the artwork that's on the page. But like, I don't think that the coloring should ever overpower, you know, what you're getting first. You know, there's one person doing something first before you, two, because the writer, you know. So it's like I had to come up with something that was efficient, that would allow it to come out, you know, like clockwork. I believe we had one delay where it didn't, but it was a very demanding project. So,
You know what? This is great. I have actually don't think I've ever enjoyed a comic book this size. So to
open, neither have I.
So to open the pages and just like being like immersed, and you know, just like amazing artwork, and just
Emmanuel, I did not know it was oversized. So when it came in the mail, I was like, "What is this?" You know, like what came in the mail? I did not know. I thought it was standard size, but it makes sense. I made sure I did those pages at 600 DPI. 1117. So they had those, so they were able to do it, because there's no stretching of images in the book, or you'll see it's like crystal clear. So and Olivia's a digital artist, so I kept it at whatever she was doing when she was drawing it and handing it in. And I did that since the first test page. I always kept it, because I thought I'm gonna have all these gorgeous pages from this big thing. I want to print it in one of those 1117 portfolios and go drop it on everyone's table when I'm pitching things and showing off. Right. So I just kept it at 600 DPI 1117. So it would be the most gorgeous prints that I could have personally when I go print stuff for my portfolio, for my physical portfolio. So yeah. So the files remain that way. I lettered the pages at that size too. So, and they definitely like continue doing that on the issues that like, when I left and I went back to Image. So
yeah, I actually at last year's Comic-Con I got to talk to Jody Hauser a little bit about writing with it, so that was fun because she plays D&D, so that was the conversation kind of skewed a little bit, but it works out. Do you keep up at all with Critical Role anymore?
I know they started. I'm so behind on it because when you're working on something. Like if I was working on, you know, a comic, I'm looking at a model of Godzilla. If I was working on a Godzilla comic, I probably wouldn't be listening and watching Godzilla things. Mm-hmm. Just because it is work, and that is doing research at the same time that you're working. And I feel like that should be like a separate time to do that, that you put aside so you can really pay attention. And plus, I don't want to always be surrounded by the content I'm working on, because we, as much as this is a licensed, well, it wasn't, it was an in-house thing, and Dark Horse had the license to publish it. But I feel like I don't want to emulate, we're doing our own thing, even though mm-hmm. we're in their sandbox, you know, and Matt's doing his own thing. And a lot of the story is, you know, a prequel. It's stuff that's not established, you know? So yeah, I mean, research on its own time, but when I'm working, I'm definitely listening to like podcasts that don't have anything to do with the subject that the book is about. So
no, that's
completely. It's not because I have a disdain for D&D or anything. I just didn't know.
No, I know plenty now.
So.
No, actually, it's kind of a trap question, because D&D is very demanding as far as time. And you're paying attention to it. Yeah, and if you're watching Critical Role, mm-hmm. it's hours. I mean, I really enjoy it, but it's
right.
hours.
And I dipped into the message boards and the Twitch stuff, and I, you know, started reading all the comments and stuff over these. You know, I said to myself, I can't possibly sit and like, mm-hmm. you know, we're starting to work on this tomorrow. I can't possibly sit and watch even 20 hours of this, you know, with the deadlines and like the production that's going on with this to get this big thing done, you know? So yeah, I mean, I watched like 2 episodes, and then I said to myself, oh, I'll just read all the comments on the Twitch, and that'll catch me up, and I'll know what's going on. And there's no way there's fans. I mean, God bless them, because they know it so well. Every comment is an inside joke right. or an inside comment. And it was not the abridged version of research that I hoped. And I would actually have to sit and consume like hundreds of hours of it.
Yeah.
You know, it's there if you want it. And I always saw people too that were like marathoning it. You know, I'm gonna get through season one. I'm gonna get through the first like section of it. Like just like marathoning it for hours. Like their fan base, there was a woman who did a cosplay of Kaelith, one of the characters in the book, and she did the costume. Maybe you saw it on my Facebook page. She did the costume like exactly the way I colored it, and exactly the way Olivia drew it, and exactly the way the two Matts like saw it. And it was to see it physically by a professional costume designer. That was a trip. But I'm sure if I was at conventions this year, I would see it all the time, you know. Mm-hmm. But because of everything, that's the thing too, it's such a bummer, like this whole 2020 is such a bummer. But man, every time something happens with Critical Role, I feel like attacked sometimes, because last year, I mean, not attacked, just unfortunate, my sister got married, so I went to her wedding when Comic-Con was happening. So I didn't get to go on the stage and like talk about stuff and promote things and everything. And it's like, I would not miss my sister's wedding, but it does not change the fact that I missed out on doing that, you know? And then this year we have this gorgeous library edition of this book, you know, that I just want to promote the hell out of. And, you know, it was, you know, published towards the holidays, which I'm sure was a decision because there was no convention. You know, mm-hmm. so they probably were like, let's do it on the holidays, which we'll have attention on it. And, but, you know, normally it would be like, I would be like with guys like you at Boots, like talking about the book and everything. So now here we are, zooming around with everybody all the time.
Yeah. Well, the great thing about the Critical Role property is that it's only going up, because they have that whole deal where they made $1 billion, and I'm obviously exaggerating, for their Kickstarter for their animated series.
For Titmouse.
Yeah. And you know, they're only making more episodes. And I think, I'm not mistaken, but Sideshow also is doing some figures from season 2.
Yes.
So, I mean, there's a whole lot more opportunity for people to pick up this wonderful book, because it's, I mean, it's going to happen, especially once I think that series comes out, more people are going to want to read it.
They're doing a prequel series of prequel comics on the individual characters now next year.
Oh, so, wow.
With all different creators. I haven't asked to color any of it or to do anything creatively on it because I'm all stocked up, thank God, for the beginning of 2021 with work in comics. So, but if the opportunity arises and there's a slot open, like if I have time, I'd love to, you know, or even if I just do a cover, you know, when someone leaves a book, they come back and they do a cover and they're like, I'm still involved. It's like happens all the time.
Chris says, if I have time, I will deal.
I'll call the editor and be like, I'll have time. It's funny because like, even 2 months ago, oh my God, the well was so dry, you know, like comics as an industry didn't know what it was doing. Like Diamonds was a disaster. Retailers didn't know what they were doing, like every other business. And comics, a lot of the times is operating on a shoestring budget as far as the retailers go. You know, not Amazon and the digital storefronts, but the, you know, the mom and pop stores, which they all are. There is no real corporate like Walmart version of a comic book store. It doesn't exist. You know, it's Comixology and that's digital. So it's been hard to watch all those stores suffer like that, you know, because their audience is very specific.
Right.
And the ones that really cared and were like, look, if you don't support these stores and get your books from the stores and not digitally or order them directly, a lot of these places aren't going to exist anymore, you know, and comic book stores serve as a community space. Mm-hmm. A lot of the time, more than actually buying the product.
Right. You know?
I mean, that's super important because it keeps it open, right? Mm-hmm. But it serves as a community space. And like, that's really what I learned at Meltdown. And the more stores I visited when I started moving around California a little bit last year, I saw that most of the stores are following that model where it's community-based and, you know, they do the miniature painting and they do they do comedy shows and they'll do like nerd date night and stuff like that. And, you know, it's nice to see. And it's sad that that doesn't exist right now. But that being said, there's plenty of Critical Role to listen to if you want to, if you got nothing to do. So just check it out.
So you talked a little bit that you're, you know, you're busy with other work. Can you tell us a little bit about what you got coming up?
Yeah, I've been working. So all the publishers were like, we're not printing anything for a while. So that happened. Mm-hmm. I had worked from November last year until August with the Action Lab working on Zombie Tramp. So I did that. But that came to an end because I think they are under stress and they can't print the books that they want to print because it's hard times, you know. So smaller companies have a lot of difficulties. So I'm not working on that anymore. This just came out from Top Cow, Stairway.
Yes.
And I love this because this is the first time, because I switched to working on an iPad instead of a PC, which I swore I would never work on an iPad ever.
Interesting.
When I lived in Ventura, my girlfriend, Kempo was, she said, you got to use an iPad. You got to use the Apple Pencil. It's so fluid and phenomenal for creating, editing, coloring, paint. Absolutely right. I fought it the whole time. The first time I saw an iPad, I said, that's a baby's toy. You know, in Back to the Future 2, when they see Wild Gunman and the kids are like, that's a baby's toy. You got to use your hands. Like, that's how I felt. So, but like this, I know you can't see, I'll send you stuff for him for your guy to cut into the video, some images and stuff. But this came out absolutely gorgeous. It's exactly what was on my iPad Pro screen.
Nice.
And it without any calibration on the device at all. I'm shocked, you know? So this just came out a few months ago from Top Cow. And what's really cool is the other project I'm working on, Doomsday Cookbook, which is created by this guy, Mark Shea, who I've known for a long time and is a really good creator. He hasn't worked in comics, but he's worked in television and film and stuff a lot. And he knows what he's talking about. This book has the art team for that book in it doing a story. So the art team on that is Christian Dabari and Simon Goh, who I have watched, and I'm sure you've seen plenty of their horror stuff. I've watched them with envy at that team and how they work together and what they produce. They have done fantastic work during this time where everyone has to stay home, like on their own thing. You know, they do this thing, Techni Horror, and they have a bunch of horror stuff going on. And I've watched for so long, you know. So when I said, when Mark said, you know, we need an art team for this book, who do you recommend? Like, you know, I'll bring on anyone you think is like the right person for this book. And it absolutely would. They were my first choice. Absolutely. So I'm thrilled to be working with them. And we have a lot of pages, and I'll send you some if you want to put them right here. I'm going to go like this and you'll put it in.
Oh yeah. We can do a little magic.
There it is. Doomsday Cookbook. Excellent story. Fantasy, sci-fi, emotional, personal. There's a lot of stuff in it that people are going to like. We were talking with Christian, and he's happy to work on something that's not 100% horror, because, you know, maybe he's getting a little typecast with the horror. He's versatile. He can do a lot. His line work is fantastic. So, and when we're talking about colorists being right for a project, I would never want anyone but Simon to color Christian. They're like, you know, like a satin glove on like the right size hand. It's just, it's amazing. So I wouldn't even try to do it. You know, I flat the pages so they come in quicker, but I would not color it. So
fantastic. But,
yeah.
Chris, thank you so much for spending some time with me this evening. I really appreciate it. And I hope that everybody goes out and gets a copy of this beauty, because it is beautiful.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.